Exxon is still saying they're not going to commit gas unless the state gives them major concessions. Conoco and BP have been very clear that they want major concessions.
Lawmakers question the gas line partnership of Exxon and TransCanada. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 12th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, federal managers gear up for disaster relief for Yukon River communities.
There's a wide range of programs that FEMA has activated, both grants and loan programs.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Legislators have a lot of questions about yesterday's announcement that Exxon and TransCanada will work together on development of a North Slope natural gas pipeline. The House Resources and Energy Committees immediately scheduled, then postponed, a hearing with the principals for next Monday. Meanwhile, the Senate Energy Committee has tentatively called for a public session with executives of the two companies the week after next. Anchorage Republican Liesl McGuire says she and co-chair Bill Wilkowski decided they need more information on the agreement itself, as well as an explanation of Exxon's interest in the project.
The state is absolutely going to be involved, needs to be involved, because while it is an agreement between two private sector companies, it is also an agreement that's going to have profound consequences on the future development of the Alaska natural gas pipeline. And the state is going to play a critical role when it comes to issues like gas certainty, fiscal certainty on gas.
She says studies had already been planned for this year on separating the state's gas tax regime from crude oil taxes, and the oil and gas industry has already become involved in the issue. She says the gas leaseholders tell her that fiscal certainty is still key to the project's viability. Democratic Representative Les Guerra says lawmakers need to know more about the agreement and how it relates to the success of the first open season next summer when leaseholders apply for space on the line. He wants to know what the legislature will be asked to do.
Exxon is still saying they're not going to commit gas unless the state gives them major concessions. Conoco and BP have been very clear that they want major concessions. And obviously, we're in a negotiating phase, right? They have to say that to maximize their profits for their shareholders. So it's what happens over the next year that really matters.
Industry observers are also wondering what exactly the partnership will look like and how significant this may be for advancing a pipeline project. Freelance writer Wesley Loy is the former business reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Loy says it's hard to say how important this development is in light of decades of announcements about a gas pipeline.
I can't remember just in the years I've been around here the number of times I've heard the word historic used with reference to developments that are said to advance the pipeline. But who knows, maybe this is the big one that really does lead to actual construction of this big project.
Well, it appears that Exxon will be in charge of building a gas treatment plant. How does this, or how would this help move the pipeline project forward?
Actually, you know, that's still sort of unclear to me whether that's really the case or not. But one thing that is the case is that the gas treatment plant that would go on the North Slope that would process the raw gas into something fit for shipping down a long, long pipeline, basically the idea is to take out the impurities. That in itself is a very, very big project, very, very expensive, and would be, from what I understand, one of the largest of its kind ever built. And so that alone would be a tremendous feat to build such a, frankly, a factory of that size on the North Slope, and it would take probably billions of dollars. You need that before you can even think about laying a pipeline.
Exxon officials yesterday said they aren't yet committing to shipping gas through a TransCanada pipeline, yet they also say they want to help TransCanada to get BP and ConocoPhillips, the Denali line people, on board. How do the two reconcile?
Yeah, that's going to be probably the most interesting plot line in this whole thing. It's conceivable that we would have both the TransCanada project and the Denali project go to this open season, each hold an open season. And neither of them, it seems to me, might attract the necessary gas to have a pipeline. And so unless there's some sort of a settlement or a meeting of the minds, a coalition, a merger coming together before each of them hold their scheduled open seasons, then, you know, you could see a scenario where you really just, in the end, don't end up with a pipeline, a viable pipeline. And probably that's what's going to be going on, is that the various parties here who are pursuing two separate pipeline projects are going to be doing a dance, and I think it will be largely out of view, largely out of public view, and they're going to try to win each other over. They're going to try to recruit one another. They're going to try to find some creative way to put something together that works for everyone and that will get everyone on board for a pipeline.
Is there any indication, do you think, that the Palin administration, there was not any mention of this yesterday, but do you think that they may offer new tax incentives to help convince Exxon to become a full partner?
Well, the Revenue Commissioner, Pat Galvin, yesterday sort of reiterated his stance that I've heard him say several times over the last few months, that they don't feel right now at least, they don't feel that there's any need to change the state's tax code to sort of sweeten up the deal of producing natural gas and sending it out of here through a pipeline. But at some point, we're going to have to talk about those, as they call them, physical terms. That's where it's been all along, and that's where it still is.
Writer Wesley Loy is the former business reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. Former state representatives Vic Coring and Pete Cott have returned to Alaska. The ex-legislators convicted in federal court of corruption charges reached Anchorage last night. Coring says he and Cott sat next to each other on the plane trip from Oregon. The two were released under orders issued Wednesday and Thursday by courts in San Francisco and Anchorage. The orders followed an announcement by the U.S. Department of Justice that prosecutors had failed to turn over favorable evidence before their 2007 trials on bribery, extortion, and conspiracy. Cott had been confined nearly a year and a half. Coring was in prison about 1 year. A hearing set for June 17th with Anchorage Judge John Sedwick will determine the conditions for their continued release until a possible new trial date can be set. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Chinook salmon are getting scarce in South Central.
At this time, it's not looking too good. It's looking like it's going to be underneath the escapement goal.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com.
Victims of last month's spring breakup floods can look for a quick response from federal and state agencies now that President Obama has declared the region a disaster area. Jeremy Zedek with the state's Division of Homeland Security says the declaration will open those communities to both public and private assistance. The state, along with federal emergency management agency teams, will begin next week to quantify the damages.
There's a wide range of programs that FEMA has activated, both grants and loan programs. Some of the programs for public infrastructure require a state match, which the state will take care of.
FEMA will cover 75% and the state will cover 25%.
Early assessments of the flood damage estimated the need for $7 million to rebuild the public infrastructure in the region. However, Zedek says that number was preliminary and was used for requesting the declaration.
Really, the total cost of this disaster won't be known until all of the projects are completed. Here in Alaska, we have a lot of transportation issues. Well, when we order items, the cost of fuel can fluctuate. So there's a lot of different variables, and we can't really say today what a project that may take years to complete will cost.
State and federal management teams will work from Bethel and Fairbanks and will be in affected communities beginning Monday. Residents will be notified of exact schedules as they are better known. Zedek says they will go building to building to look at damage to make more detailed estimates of costs. They will also recommend various programs that will provide funding for the relief. Residents of Eagle haven't been idle, waiting for help from the federal government. Since just a few days after last month's devastating flood and ice crush, the people of this small community have quickly organized and started helping each other. As in many rural Alaska villages, the school often doubles as a community gathering place. For Eagle, it's become a place to get food, water, clothing, and other supplies.
We've gone from emergency food and shelter, and now we're trying to start getting supplies for cleanup.
Cynthia Goins supervises the distribution of donations to Eagle residents. She says people are assessing their loss and figuring out how to rebuild, but things will never be the same.
It's going to be a whole new town. My home is high on a hill, and my home is fine. But it feels like the disaster happened to me because so many people that I love lost everything they have. And we will rebuild, and we will all be fine. And hopefully we'll all be closer, but we're a pretty close-knit community anyway.
Even weeks later, tears are close to the surface for many of Eagle's residents. Stacy Pare is a city councilor and the Eagle School cook. She and others have been preparing three meals a day at the school for displaced residents for more than a month. She lost her home and said the Genie subdivision, the area that was hardest hit, is what residents now call ground zero. In the kitchen preparing lunch, she talks about looking through the mud and ice for her things and finding a makeshift memorial.
There was a flag and a plaque that said Ground Zero, gave the date, and leaning against it was a driftwood angel that my mother had made. And somebody had obviously set that all up. We have been able to find bits and pieces of things, but so much of it is just destroyed or just like we can't find it. It's just so mixed and jumbled in with ice, and all of our neighbors' stuff is all strewed together in one big stew pot.
She says the noise of crashing and booming ice the night of the flood was terrifying as she scrambled to escape the frigid, rising water.
We had some time to go back in and to try to look at your walls and your things and try to decide in a rush what to grab and what's important. Was one of the hardest things that I ever had to do.
Mark Malcolm grew up in Eagle. He is the father of two small sons and says when the worst of the flooding and ice began inundating the town, he had secured his young family with friends, but was nearly swept away when he tried to get home to rescue one of his dogs. He had to ditch the bike he was riding and run hard to stay ahead of the water until he reached high ground at the airstrip.
I seen a little bit of high ground up there and I'm thinking, oh God, it's the airport. So I just hightailed it up there, and I was like, oh, the airport, yes, yes. I was never so happy to see high ground. I was just up there just hopping up and down, screaming and yelling, you know, I made it, I beat you, I made it, I beat you. And I'm thinking, oh, no, my family, they don't know where I'm at. I start walking down the airport, you know, as fast as I can because I'm just tired out from running through the woods. And there was a spot along the stretch that this guy had cleared out with a bunch of equipment. And when I looked over there like this, I could see it, and I seen ice, white ice, right there in the road. And I'm thinking that, man, if I would have stayed back in that spot back there a couple minutes longer, that ice would have came right over that riverbank and got me. And I'm still traumatized a little bit today about it. You know, it's just something that it's going to take a while for me to get over.
Malcolm was reunited with his dog, and his family remained safe. But he says the emotional impact is still close, as evidenced in a drawing his young son made for him.
And it was a picture of the shop kind of pushed up against this treehouse. And over here you could see how he'd drawn ice. And it was just, you know, the destruction that he had seen after it was all done. And at the bottom of it, it said, "Sorry, Mom and Dad." It just broke my heart because, you know, he's 5 years old and he draws this picture for us. Sorry, Mom and Dad.
Multi-ton chunks of melting ice still litter the area where the old village of Eagle used to be. The scene looks like a war zone. For 300 yards inland from the banks of the Yukon, and for a two-mile stretch, the area is a muddy jumble of uprooted trees, fuel tanks, overturned vehicles, and crushed homes. Village Public Safety Officer Tim Bocaz says once the water was about 5 feet above the shoreline, the ice started its terrible work.
There was a basketball court right back here, and the basketball hoops are 10 foot off the cement, and they were totally submerged.
Nearby, crews worked to stabilize the tundra mats that comprise the temporary road from the old community to the new village site. Artem Rupert is with the Alaska Department of Transportation. Rupert says the new road that was pushed through after Mission Road was blocked will aid residents as they work to salvage what they can.
So people will have 24-hour access from Eagle to a new village and going back and forth. But as far as next phase of clearing debris from Mission Road, I anticipate work might be completed by very early July.
Back at the school, retired principal Terry McMullen says the psyche of Eagle residents has taken a terrible blow. He echoes what others say about the close relationships in the community and how all will work together. But he worries that even though there will now be federal aid, government programs take time, and that's a fleeting commodity in the North.
One thing about it, you know, it's June, and, you know, September is right around the corner, and that's when, you know, we might get into October with some decent weather to work, but that's it. And so, you know, I mean, people are looking and knowing that. And if, you know, whether if people have the wherewithal to rebuild their homes, some guys are just going to have to take apart what they've had and start from scratch and build again. Now, whether that's going to happen by the winter or not, you know, there's people looking at other options now that never had to do that before.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/Copper River. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business, or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
South Central Alaska anglers are hurting due to sport fishing closures affecting a number of king salmon streams. The Susitna Valley's Deshka River closes to king fishing starting tomorrow, and emergency closures are affecting popular fishing sites from Kodiak to the Copper Basin. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
What is known is that there is a poor king salmon return. What is not known is why. The Deshka River, long a mecca for salmon anglers, is seeing such poor escapement that it will be closed to sport king fishing for the duration of the season. Sam Ivey, Alaska Fish and Game's assistant sport fish manager for the Palmer area, says the goal for Deshka Kings was between 13,000 and 28,000 fish. To date, far fewer kings have passed the weir on the river.
By this time, on average, we would see about a quarter of the run materialize on the Deshka River, and we're not seeing that. We have 1,285 fish through the weir right now. We should see several thousand. Yesterday's count of 420 was good, but at this point, we're still only projecting half of the low end of the escapement goal. We're still projecting to not meet that 13,000 low end.
The average actual escapement each season for the past decade has been more than 5,000 to Kings. Ivy says the drop in numbers was apparent last year when the Deshka King sport fishing season closed early due to emergency order.
We are seeing that now. This past season, we missed our escapement goal, and this year it appears that we're going to miss our escapement goal for a second time, and that's why the Deshka will be closed down tomorrow morning.
By Fish and Game projections, close to 6,000 fish may still reach the Deshka spawning grounds, but unless things change as the run develops, all returning fish will be required for spawning escapement. The Northern District commercial king salmon fishery will be closed as well for the final two Monday commercial fishing periods. But Ivy says at this time, no other area closures are under consideration. Ivy says the restriction is not irreversible. Fish and Game will continue to monitor the weir on the Deshka through silver salmon season, and if the King Run improves soon, the closure could be lifted, although he does not extend false hope.
At this time, it's not looking too good. It's looking like it's going to be underneath the escapement goal.
Similar king salmon closures are being ordered on other sport fishing streams, like the Kenai Peninsula's Anchor River and Kodiak's Karluk and Iakulik Rivers, which will close to king salmon sport fishing next week. Less than 200 kings have passed the weir on the Karluk, compared with 2,000 kings a year ago at this time. Eastern Alaska's Copper River Basin is also feeling the pain. An emergency order closed the popular Copper River dipnet fishery to the retention of any king salmon earlier this week. Lynn Perry Plake is an assistant area manager in Glen Allen.
We did because we have a concern as far as what we're seeing for return of Chinook this year coming up the Copper. The commercial harvest was less than anticipated. It's the lowest harvest that, you know, we have seen to date since 1969. And that, along with not actually having observed any Chinook passing our count tower and the Gulkana, which is a major tributary to the Copper.
Perry Plake says anecdotal reports indicate few harvesters are taking more than one king, or Chinook, as they are also called. Normally, dip netters are allowed to keep one king salmon, but most years catch more than that, she says. Perry Plake says conservation concerns have prompted the emergency restriction. She says the famed Copper River sockeye salmon run appears to be normal this year. King and sockeye salmon runs coincide in the Copper, and normally the kings precede the sockeye by a couple of days.
We started counting sockeye on the 4th of June, and we just counted our first Chinook yesterday, which was the 11th. So it's a little switch in you know, what we usually see.
Perry Plake says the restriction could be lifted through emergency order if the situation changes. So far, there is no definitive answer as to why the low king salmon numbers are occurring. Sam Ivey says there's a wide range of theories, including juvenile survival, warming temperatures, or predation. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Meanwhile, subsistence fishermen in the Yukon River are seeing a good start to their Chinook salmon run. KYUK's Shane Iverson reports.
Ice moved onto the Yukon late this year, so it's no surprise that the Chinook or King Salmon run is a bit late. Subsistence fishers in the downriver area reported activity during a management teleconference call hosted by the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association. In some villages, fishers have done quite well. John Lamont lives in Mountain Village, about 100 miles from the coast. He said that the King Run was starting to pick up there.
Last night I went out and made a 30-minute drift, and I caught eight kings and one jack. The guy behind me, my brother, he caught close to 40 kings and two drifts, and we're done for the year.
But along the coast, the run has varied. Near the northern branches of the Yukon, Kotlik residents are yet to catch any fish. But farther south, Imanak has seen a good start to the king season. Robert Moore is a resident there.
The guy, not too far from me, he set his net for what few hours, and he got 16 kings and pulled his net out.
Imanak was hard hit by flooding in May during the Yukon's violent breakup. Resident Nick Tucker says the damage caused by flooding is now combining with financial hardships.
Some of the fish
camps and smokehouses, drying racks, tents, and tent frames have either been flood damaged or demolished, and a lot of debris at camps, and some have lost their nets and gear.
Tucker says only a handful of families have nets in the water, and Hamilton says even those with gas money aren't ready to hang and dry fish.
Camps are still drying out, and as a result, there's very little effort. Most people going out right now are catching fish for the freezer.
Fish and game biologists have predicted a below-average to poor run of Yukon Kings this year, but Moore is hopeful that the run may be better than expected.
I've been fishing in the mouth of the Yukon for 50-plus years. It's been a while since I see kings coming in first and heavier than the chums, so in years like that, we've experienced a heavy run of kings, so hopefully that'll be the case.
It's too early to tell how the run will pan out. Subsistence fishers in the lower Yukon are under a tight set of restrictions. That includes just 2 18-hour fishing periods per week. Fish and game biologist Steve Hayes said that one or two of those periods may be canceled to ensure a higher amount of kings make it to their spawning grounds.
Conserve the greatest number of Canadian down Chinook salmon, there will be no fishing on the first pulse of Chinook salmon.
Hayes says the king run occurring now doesn't constitute a pulse.
You know, the pulse usually consists of 3 to 4 days of really high numbers, but you also have those days on both sides are a little lower. So we're watching as the numbers start to increase.
When the pulse is detected, Fish and Game will call for district closures as it travels upriver. After some successful fishing, Umonex Robert Moore is hopeful that a strong run could help make up for the tighter restrictions.
It's been years since I've met my niece in a day and a half, so that's an indicator to me that we do have hopefully a healthy run.
Despite some early promising signs, there are no plans to hold a commercial fishery on the Yukon this year. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Two experienced climbers have fallen to their deaths on Alaska's Mount McKinley. National Park Service rangers have recovered the bodies of 39-year-old John Mitzlow of Newton, Massachusetts, and 36-year-old Andrew Swanson of Minneapolis. The climbers, both doctors, were roped together when they fell yesterday afternoon. Alaska's confirmed H1N1 influenza cases jumped by 7 today for a total of 21. According to the Alaska Department of Health and Human Services, the new confirmed additions include one each in Skagway, Homer, and Anchorage, with 2 cases in both Fairbanks and Juneau. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers is Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.